It's kind of living the dream. How did Rick Steves turn backpacking trips to Europe into a $20 million a year travel business, which includes 27 guidebooks, tours, travel products, a public TV show, and public radio show heard on KUOW each Saturday at 2? Why is he a leader in the movement to legalize marijuana use for adults in Washington State? And what is next for serial entrepreneur Rick Steves? Well, he happens to be sitting here, so let's find out. Rick, thanks so much for being with us today.
Nice to be here, Ross.
You've got such an interesting story to your life, and I'd like to get to that. You grew up in Edmonds, is that right?
Yeah.
And why do you stay there?
I can still look out the window of my office and see my old junior high school. And why do I stay there? I don't know. I guess it's easier to travel a lot when you love where you live and you've got those firm roots. And I just really, really like coming back. And it's my community.
When Rick Steves was growing up, what did he have in his head for what he wanted to be when he grew up?
I wanted to be a piano teacher. Until I was well into college, I really, really just loved teaching piano. I had 50 students up in Edmonds. I had my own piano studio. I had a recital hall. I had a girlfriend who was a piano teacher. We were going to move in together and move our grand pianos together. You know how two grand pianos can kind of nestle together the way they're shaped. And and then all of a sudden, I started traveling. My dad used to import pianos from Germany, so he took me over there as a kid, and I was exposed to European culture and the adventure of travel. And I had this recital hall in downtown Edmonds, and I would use it for teaching travel classes. And I decided when I was about 20, 24 or something like that, 25, I had to decide, I got to do one or the other. And I let my students go, and I just turned my piano studio into a lecture hall. And ever since then, I've been doing the same thing, trying to help people learn from my mistakes so they can travel smoother, enjoying maximum travel thrills for every mile, minute, and dollar, as I like to say. And it's interesting, Russ, when I look back, because I've been doing this now for 30 years, and I've got the same mission and the same passion, and I'm surprised I'm just as fresh now as I was back then about the whole adventure of it. And what I've got is 80 wonderful employees that work with me, and I've got technology beyond my wildest dreams to help amplify our teaching. And we're able to do stuff to share our lessons and help Americans travel smarter that is just so fun and energizing.
Now, you went to the University of Washington and you got a business degree. And did you have in your mind that you would make a travel business out of this when you were getting that business
degree? Oh, not at all. That was a very happy coincidence that I happened to get 2 degrees at the UW. I got a history degree because that was my love, European history.
Yeah.
And then I think my parents must have said, well, you better get something so you can have a decent job. So I thought, okay, I'll get a business degree. And as it turns out, those are probably the two best degrees I could have because I have to run this business. And when I think back on it, of course, the business degree is the, quote, practical degree. But I honestly think my history degree has been of more help to me as a citizen and a businessman in my work than even the business degree.
Why is that? Particularly in the business realm, I could see it as a citizen.
In my work, because I'm a teacher, and I really believe we can learn from the past. And if you don't know where you're coming from, it's hard to know where you're going.
Yeah.
And I draw on that a lot. And plus, in my history degree, I had to learn how to communicate well and write well, I think. And I just really, I run across a lot of people in growing my business, and it is rare to find people who can communicate clearly and concisely and write well. And that's not something you always learn in your vocational training.
No.
But if you can pick that up anyway in your education, I think that's going to serve you really well in the long course.
Now, you mentioned the classes that you started up in Edmonds, but I read that you were teaching a Europe 101 course through the University of Washington's Experimental College. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That was my first big gig. And I remember as a kid in my 20s thinking, this is just too good to be true. The wonderful Experimental College gave me an audience. And when I think back, how did I get into this? I wanted to go on that hippie bus road from Istanbul to Kathmandu. So I took a class back in 76 or 75 at the Experimental College from a guy who did the trip from Istanbul to Kathmandu. He was so lazy and ill-prepared, and he had all that experience and all that information, and he had 20 kids, backpackers in that class, wanting to get a little advice, and it was completely worthless. And I was so frustrated by that. And then as I
thought traveled, I could do better than that.
I realized the value of information, how to share information from travel experience to people who have travel dreams that need to get it into focus. So that sort of inspired me. So I thought, okay, I learned early on I'm not going to get my piano students to practice in the summer, so I'm taking off for Europe. I'll see you guys in September. So every summer I'd do a 3-month or 10-week trip in between my piano teaching. And I remember I just thought, okay, I'll teach a class about how to travel. I signed up. It was like seven or eight Wednesdays in a row. And
yeah.
I hadn't ridden it yet, and I thought a few students would sign up. And 60 or 70 parents signed up.
Yeah, that was kind of a surprise to you. You thought it would be students, yeah. but there were older people.
And I really struck a chord yeah. with the traveling public. And older people wanted to travel with the confidence and the footloose and fancy freeness of younger kids, of backpackers.
Yeah.
But they wanted to stay in hotels and they didn't want to take risks. So I found my little niche there, blew me away. And pretty soon, back then I was charging $8 for the class. And I remember, I mean, it's just incredible. I'd leave my dorm. I'd leave Haggett Hall with 100 $2 bills. And I'd go to the class, give my talk, and I'd come home with 100 $10 bills.
Whoa.
And I thought, there's my trip. And I couldn't believe I was telling travel stories and making enough money to pay for my plane ticket. And ever since then, I've been doing the same thing. And I mean, I still, for 30 years, I've spent 4 months a year in Europe. I travel generally alone, and I just go over there having as many experiences, making as many mistakes, taking careful notes, and then coming home and designing all that travel experience into whatever material that we are offering at Europe Through the Back Door. And, you know, our mantra is content is king.
Right.
I don't know how it's going to be spun or how it's going to show itself, digital this, online that.
And I want to get to that, like how you're dealing with the new media environment. But as you alluded to before, you have a philosophy of travel. In fact, you've said that spending money only builds a thicker wall between you and what you came to see. You said mm-hmm. that at one time.
Right.
Well, could you describe that philosophy in more depth for us?
I say that all the time because that's sort of the foundation of Europe Through the Back Door. We want to travel close to the ground. And the more you spend, the fancier hotel you're in, and then you're surrounded by people who just want to make money off you. They start salivating when they know you've got a lot of money. When you stay in, let's say, a bed and breakfast instead of a Sheraton hotel. Okay, in a bed and breakfast, you're having tea with the lady who runs the place. It's a farm that's making ends meet by renting out a few rooms. You're out there seeing the kid shear the sheep, and you get to talk to them about how the prices used to be so low that they would just burn the wool, and now they find that they use it for insulation or mm-hmm. something, and they can turn a buck on that. It's just you get intimate with the culture, not because you're spending more, but because you're spending less. So I've always found that what carbonates the travel experience is meeting people. If I'm putting a tour together or making a TV show or writing a guidebook, if I'm not connecting people with people, it's going to be a flat experience. And that's what really, I think, distinguishes our program.
Well, in fact, you said at one time, you're quoted as saying that you were on a personal crusade to put soft Americans into miserable hotel rooms. True?
Whoa, you did your research. Yeah, that was, I used to have that attitude where I thought, you know, I've always been interested in homeless issues and kind of like that. Because as a kid, I traveled around Europe and I was generally homeless. And I'm just a rich suburban American, you know, as far as real homeless people go. But I was over there struggling on a shoestring, on a budget, you know, the whole $5 a day thing. And I would generally just crash somewhere. And it was kind of on the edge. And I gained an empathy for people that don't just have a few tight accommodation stories in their vacation, but who it's a daily grind of where am I going to sleep tonight. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to let the people who took my tours in the early days, I wanted them to understand how lucky we were to have beautiful accommodations. And I thought a good way to give people an appreciation of how good they have it is to let them have lousy accommodations.
Did they all appreciate that?
No, they didn't. But that was back in the old days when all I took in my first aid kit was a little Ziploc baggie of Valium, you know, if they were all stressed out. These days, we've matured in our tour approach. And we give people comfortable base from which to have their perspective broaden. But what I like to do, I just find the most precious souvenir you can take home is a broader perspective and an empathy for the other 96% of humanity, and not to be threatened by people who are different, but to celebrate that.
Rick Steves is my guest, that familiar voice, the travel maven, and also we're going to talk about his political activism coming up in a few moments. You hear him on KUOW on Saturdays at 2 o'clock. You know, I was listening to this interview with Richard Branson the other day, the guy behind Virgin Records and Virgin Airlines, and he reminded me of you in one way, Rick Steves. He's the brand, and Rick Steves is kind of very much the face and the brand of your business. Now, I'm sure there's advantages to that. Are there disadvantages to that, to be so personally associated with it? You're a bright, cheery guy on television. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like I got to be a bright, cheery guy all the time because that's what people think of you are, who you are?
Well, I'm lucky because when people recognize me, they always have something happy to say. They had a great trip. They were just in the Cinque Terre. I love Paris. Down in Sicily, it's fantastic. Oh, I was hiking in Norway. So it just stokes me, and I work really hard. I work probably too hard, but it's my vacation. I don't really take a vacation. I go to Europe and work on my books and my TV shows, and I get to meet people all the time that are having great travel experiences. It's very gratifying, and it sort of inspires me to work harder. So I really, I can be kind of lazy socially because everywhere I go, as long as I don't mind talking about travel, I've got people to talk to.
What if you don't want to talk about travel, Rick Steves? What happens then? Well, like, enough already. I don't want to talk about travel.
Ross, if you went to my living room, you'd sit there and you'd look around and there's no indication that I'm a traveler.
Really?
Yeah.
What would I see?
Well, you'd see books and you'd see a nice view of the harbor from Edmonds.
What would I be surprised to see in your living room, Rick Steves? If I just know you as Rick Steves.
You'd be surprised to see what I call a silver fox. It's a little tiny stuffed animal wearing these hippie glasses with marijuana leaves on them.
Oh, I wouldn't be entirely surprised to see that. 9/11, huge travel collapse across the industry. I'm wondering how that affected your business.
Well, 9/11, I've always thought is overrated.
For its impact on travel?
Yeah. I mean, no, for its impact on America.
Okay.
We lost 2,800 people out of 300 million. And this is dicey stuff, but this is what I talk about all over the United States. I just went on a 20-city and 20-day road trip from Seattle to Tallahassee every night in a different city, small town, conservative towns, whenever possible. And I was trying to explain that, you know, if 96% of humanity looks at us as if we're an empire, we're going to be treated like an empire. And there's never been an empire that didn't have angry people on its fringes nipping at it. Romans had barbarians. Habsburgs had anarchists. America has terrorists, you know. It's a horrible thing, 9/11. I don't want to diminish the loss of life and all that kind of thing. It's awful. But does it need to change our whole way of approaching life and the rest of the world and all that kind of stuff? Because 300 million people who are the wealthiest people on this planet, the most powerful people on this planet, the only people on this planet who can declare other people's natural resources on the other side of the planet vital to our, quote, national security interest. When those people who own that resources would appreciate it if we were candid enough to say vital to our accustomed material lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, we've got some angry people on our fringes and it's just going to happen. So, you know, 4% of the United States, we spend as much as everybody else put together on military. And right now we're going to vote for a president who's promising more for the military. It's a real problem. And when we travel, we put things in perspective. Yeah, that was bad. That was a tragedy. But every country has had those tragedies. And one thing I've been interested in lately is cultural baggage. Every country has cultural baggage. America has 9/11 baggage right now. Before, we had Vietnam baggage. We had Pearl Harbor baggage. We had Depression baggage. Well, other countries have their baggage, too. Iran has Iran-Iraq war baggage. They lost 200,000 people when they were invaded just 20 or 30 years ago by Saddam Hussein. That's a big deal.
You're a very outspoken business person, and there was a profile of you at the New York Times that in 2004, they said you earned the trust of older and less cosmopolitan Americans with your methodical research and good cheer, and in large part, wrote the New York Times, by keeping your liberal leanings just under the radar. Was that true 8 years ago? Is that less true today?
Well, I don't know about liberal leanings under the radar, but for 25 years, I was a tour guide with a bully pulpit and a captive audience. I mean, here I am, 20 days with these people. Mm-hmm. They're typical American cross-section. And here I am trying to give them an appreciation for European perspectives. I can do that, I believe, with the help of my staff that coaches me a lot in this, with respect and without being divisive, but just appealing to people's interest in making things better. There are different people on this planet who are just as good and caring as us that find different truths to be self-evident and God-given. And as soon as we recognize that, we can talk with them and compare notes. I just love that. So my job as a travel writer is to get Americans out of their comfort zone, to shake up their ethnocentricity, and to function today like the medieval jester functioned in the Middle Ages. The king used to give the jester room and board to be annoying. He would go outside of the castle, learn what was out there, come back, and tell the king the truth like nobody else could.
Are you the jester?
I'm the jester. And so are my travelers, I hope.
Okay. Rick Steves is my guest. You know, I can remember talking to you when you were just starting your radio show. We had a conversation. I got a chance to see your facility up there in Edmonds, and we went out to have a coffee. This must have been 2002, 2003. And I kind of want to trace back your political activism because I seem to remember at that time the city of Edmonds had put up American flags all over downtown.
Right.
And you kind of took a stand on that that might have been kind of unpopular with some people in Edmonds. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was one of the most thought-provoking or controversial things I've done in my community, I think. But my flag is my flag, just like somebody who is on the other side of political issue and things. And they had those flags up there supporting the war in Iraq. And I thought, fine for a little while. But the word was they were going to be up there until the troops had come home, until the war was over. And I talked with the Lions Club, and they agreed that we should take them down. They didn't take them down. So in the defense of our flag, to not belittle it, to make it be a political logo for people who supported the war, who I respect, but they don't get to hijack my flag, I took the flags down. And people got all upset about that because, like, I don't like the flag. But ironically, I can make a very good case for it. It was out of love of my flag and love of my country and our freedom that we don't diminish our flag to become just having people on the right to have a flag on their lapel is kind of silly, because I really believe people on the left love their flag and their country just as much. And our political activism is because we care and love about our country and our freedom. So I get this opportunity. You know, Ross, if I look back on my teaching for 30 years now, it's kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where first you cover your basic needs, then you get a roof over your head and enough food and shoes, then you get more creative and fulfilling and actually altruistic on the very top. If I look at my teaching, in the 80s, it was all cheap tricks, Europe through the back door, Europe through the back door, budget travel. And then in the 90s, and I wrote that book, Europe Through the Back Door. In the 90s, I wrote a book called Europe 101, History and Art for the Traveler. We got our hotel. We got our meal. We stayed healthy. Now we're going to enjoy what we came for, the history, art, the wine, the cuisine, and so on. And then in the last decade, my passion has slipped even higher on that traveler's Maslow's hierarchy, and to the very pinnacle of the pyramid, which I think is traveling in a way that broadens our perspective. And that was my book, Europe as a Political Act, Travel as a Political Act. And that was really inspired by 9/11 and our country's reaction to it.
When you were you this way your entire life? I mean, when you were a youngster or a teenager or in college, were you active politically, taking perhaps unpopular stands? Or is this something that comes to you later?
No, to me, it's so clear. It's just when you travel, you gain an. When you leave your country, you can look back at your country and see it in high contrast, and you can recognize problems and challenges that you could never see if you're right in the middle of it. I feel so strongly about that. Unfortunately, a lot of people are blessed enough to go travel, but they don't bother to look back. And then they come home and they're not changed. And to me, that's a lost opportunity. I completely can respect people that have differing opinions, but we need to challenge ourselves to learn from the rest of the world, to realize that the only thing exceptional about the United States is our ability to think that we're exceptional.
You're kind of at the forefront of the I-502 initiative to legalize marijuana. You've been the leader for a long time, a regular speaker at HempFest. And I-502 is polling way ahead, the last stuff that I saw. Do you think that's an accurate picture of where we are on this issue?
Well, I don't know. I'm kind of impressed that we're polling at 57%.
Yeah.
We haven't even started our advertising campaign in vigor yet. And tomorrow I'm embarking on a 7-day, 15-city road trip around our state to talk up the beauties of initiative 502. And I want to stress, it's not pro-pot. You can be pro-pot, but this initiative is not pro-pot. This initiative is anti-prohibition. Most people's arguments against legalizing, taxing, and regulating marijuana are based on the assumption use will go up.
Yeah.
Now, I bring my European perspective, and there's no society that has gone progressive on laws against marijuana that has seen use go up. If we legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana, first of all, I don't think use is going to go up. And then there's a lot of reasons to be excited about the beauties of ending this expensive and going nowhere prohibition against marijuana.
Well, it's not just the marijuana initiative. I was at an event and a state senator handed me a postcard, and it was a fundraiser at your house for Senate Democrats. Is this new for you, or have you been a fundraiser for Senate Democrats for a while now?
Oh, I'm a Democrat through and through.
Uh-huh.
I just really believe that we're a family and we should work together. And and I believe in progressive taxation. And, if the Republicans win, I'm going to save a lot of money because my taxes are going to go down. And I'm doing everything I can to help Democrats win so I can pay more taxes, because I care about my community. And I'm the best capitalist in my town. I mean, I employ 80 people really well, and I make a lot of money at it. And I'm capitalist through and through. But I found in my travels that even if you're motivated only by greed, if you know what's good for you, you don't want to be filthy rich in a desperately poor world. It's not a pretty picture. And if you don't know that, go south of our border and see what it's like.
Rick Steves, do you think you'll ever go more actively into politics? Could you see yourself as a candidate for office?
I flirted with the idea, but I don't think I would be very good.
Why not?
I can do more talking like this, not worrying about fashioning all my words to make sure it resonates properly with the right market segment and so on, you know. And I'm actually accomplishing quite a bit, making plenty of money and then raising my voice in issues that I really care about as a travel writer. I've found my niche and I'm having fun at it. And I feel like you know, I don't know when I'm going to burn out on this, but I go to Europe for 2 2-month trips a year. I'm over there for 60 days at a stretch, working 60 14-hour days in a row. And when I come home, I feel younger and more energized and more enthusiastic about what I'm doing than when I left home. So I'm pretty lucky to guy to have that niche. And then if I can raise my voice as a travel writer and challenge our country to fit better into this ever smaller world, I'm very, very happy with that. And I got to say, it's pledge time. I'm thankful that there is public broadcasting where we can actually talk about this stuff without worrying about offending advertisers. As I say on TV and radio, it's beautiful to have one place on the dial where we can assume an attention span, respect people's intelligence, and talk like this without worrying about offending some advertiser.
I got to say, 206-543-9595. Rick Steves, thank you so much for sharing your enthusiasm with us. We appreciate it.
It's a delight to talk to you, Ross. Thank you.
It's KUOW.